Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Stephen Seewer. I chair the club's LGBT member forum and I'll be your moderator for tonight's program. We also welcome our listening audience and we invite everyone to visit us at commonwealthclub.org. Our speaker this evening is journalist and author Mike Weiss. In 1978 and 1979, Mike did extensive reporting on the assassinations of Mayor George Moscone and Supervisor Harvey Milk while working for Rolling Stone and Time magazine. Tonight, Mike is here to discuss his award-winning book, Double Play, The Hidden Passions Behind the Double Assassination of George Moscone and Harvey Milk. Double Play stands as an essential source about a time in the city's history that is iconic, formative, and devastating. Double Play provides an intimate look into the lives of three men who came to City Hall from divergent paths. Mike details the rise to power, how City Hall impacted them, and the events leading up to the tragic assassinations. Mike's research is astounding, and his perceptions are poignant with great compassion for the shocking events of the day. Mike Weiss was an award-winning reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle and is a recipient of the Edgar Award from the Mystery Writers of America for his narrative account of the assassinations. Please welcome Mike Weiss.
Do a little two-step here.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you, Stephen. And thank you to the members of the club for inviting me. I'm very pleased to be here. And I want to assure you that I'm going to let everybody get out of here before dark, which is not much of a promise on the longest day of the year. What I'm going to do tonight is simply recreate the assassinations and the trial that followed and the events that followed that leading through the time of Dan White's suicide. And try to answer some of the questions that I know still trouble people who think about this sad event in the city's history. I'd like to bend that down a little. When Dan White went down to City Hall to assassinate Mayor George Moscone and his fellow supervisor, Harvey Milk, he definitely had a plan. He was very methodical in its preparation and its execution. He oiled his gun. He filled the gun with five cartridges and then took 10 extra cartridges out of their styrofoam slots, which involved pulling each one out individually. He couldn't just dump them and wrap them in a handkerchief and put them in his pocket. He shaved, he showered, he put on a suit and tie. He told the aide who came to pick him up, Denise Abkar, on his way to City Hall, that he planned to give George and Harvey a piece of his mind. He borrowed Denise's car keys, so there was a getaway vehicle ready. He entered the City Hall through the Polk Street steps, saw that the policeman on the metal detector was not known to him. He knew a lot of cops. He had been a cop himself, and he was now a city supervisor. So he reversed course, went outside, found a window on the side of the building, climbed through the window, went up a back staircase, hesitated again at the door to the mayor's office because he knew on the other side of that door was the mayor's security detail, waited for a clerk to come along. The door was open. He snuck in the back door. He killed George Moscone by emptying his former service revolver into him. The last two shots, he straddled Moscone's fallen body and put the shots into the back of his head. Then he did something very similar, crossed City Hall, reloaded, crossed City Hall, assassinated Harvey in just exactly the same way. And he even provided a kind of explanation for what had happened. He had ripped off and put into his jacket pocket the cover or the fly leaf of a book by Leon Uris called Ireland, a Terrible Beauty. And when he turned himself in at Northern Station and he was asked if he had anything to say, he simply handed over that piece of paper that he was carrying in his pocket as an explanation. Am I talking loud enough to be heard? Good. At his trial, several months after these carefully planned and executed events, He was convicted not of premeditated murder, but of the lesser crime of voluntary manslaughter. Dan White would serve only about 6 years in state prison. That night, the night of his verdict, City Hall came under attack. In my entire life, I don't think I've ever seen anything that gave me more shivers than what happened at City Hall on the night of the Dan White verdict. Hundreds and hundreds of people, many thousands came, but hundreds and hundreds feeling exposed and vulnerable and frightened and furious, literally attacked the seat of government. They knocked down pieces of stone and metal, they smashed the windows, and they set afire 9 police cars so that the whole scene took on a phantasmagoric aspect. You had the light of the burning cars and their sirens bleeding and the crowd chanting and cops and protesters fighting each other literally in the street. It wasn't a riot. It was a fight. At any rate, I had been there for every day of the trial, and I was there again in Civic Center that night. And after the trial, I felt very, very strongly that the trial itself had failed to provide satisfactory answers to most of the questions that San Franciscans had about those terrible events. The trial, in the end, didn't tell you a great deal about why Dan White assassinated Harvey Milk, his fellow office holder. It certainly didn't get into any question of whether Harvey was killed because he was gay, a question I think still lingers in many people's minds. Was this what we would nowadays call a hate crime? And we also wondered, I think, at the time, how Dan White got away with what so clearly seemed to be a cold-blooded murder. As we will see, he eventually confessed to his having a plan on that day, but that was many years later after justice or injustice had been done. So it was to answer those questions that I undertook to write the book. George Moscone was a native San Franciscan. He had served in the state Senate where he had rose to a leadership position. He was a little bit of what we would call in later years a prince of the city. He drove an Alfa Romeo. He closed many a joint throughout the town. As his good friend Willie Brown said about George, he said, you know, George's only problem is that when he's had 2 drinks, he thinks he's invisible. And George was swept into office in he won the mayoralty in 1976 with the backing of gays, of neighborhood organizations, with a new force in city politics that was spearheaded by the Burton brothers and Willie Brown and their Democratic machine. George Moscone was part and parcel of that. Harvey Milk's background was very, very different. Harvey came from New York. He was a smart New York Jew, liked to crack wise, and he had a background in finance and the theater. He had been in the Navy. He had played football in high school. But eventually, he became the Rosa Parks of the gay movement. He was the fellow who stood up and went to the front of the bus and said, I'm going to be a city supervisor. I'm gay, and I'm going to be elected. And, of course, he was, which was quite an extraordinary thing, especially because at that time in the city, in the mid-70s, San Francisco was undergoing an integration crisis, maybe the only gay integration crisis in history, but it certainly was an integration crisis. It was, as far as I can tell, the first time in human history that large numbers of homosexual people openly lived in one neighborhood, made it their neighborhood, and demanded their full rights and protections of the law. And it was an historic moment, and it did cause a great deal of consternation. The rest of San Francisco, whether of goodwill or ill, simply didn't know how to cope very easily with this new phenomenon. And so there was an enormous amount of tension in the city. And there was also an enormous amount of tension over George Moscone as becoming mayor because of his coalition, because of the way he had routed the more traditional city hall forces, and also because of the way he lived. It was not unusual in those days for cops to say to people, would you like to hear my George Moscone tapes? And another thing he did is he appointed a police chief who was an outsider who immediately, and this was a very, very tactful move on his part, removed the American flag from his office and was very much hated by his rank and file, so that in many police stations on the bulletin board was a picture of Police Chief Charles Gain, who was seen as George Moscone's creature, in the crosshairs of a gun. Dan White, like George Moscone, grew up in San Francisco, but whereas George grew up in the Marina and in Cal Hollow, Dan grew out in the southeast corner of the city in those faded neighborhoods where if you stand on the hilltop and look down over Visitation Valley, you can see sheets and underwear flapping on hundreds of clotheslines, all the sheets well worn. He had absolutely no background in politics. He had wanted to be a writer. He had become a policeman. He had become a fireman. Eventually, he became a city supervisor. But he only had a high school education. And therefore, he brought with him to City Hall a kind of high school civics idea of how politics was conducted. Dan White was very naive, and he thought that the way it would work in the Board of Supervisors was that every supervisor would put forward his ideas and the best ideas would prevail. George Moscone and Harvey Milk knew better than that. They knew that the idea that would prevail was the idea that had 6 votes because there were 11 members on the Board of Supervisors, and that in order to be a successful politician at City Hall, more than any other skill, you needed to be able to count to 6. Dan White didn't know how to do that. And yet, he had a certain kinship with Harvey Milk. The two men had a very complex and very hard-to-fathom relationship. Harvey obviously, he made a lot of fun of Dan, but he was somewhat fascinated by him, and Dan was certainly fascinated by Harvey. Dan felt that both he and Harvey represented at City Hall constituencies that had not previously been spoken for in City Hall. Nonetheless, the two men didn't see eye to eye ideologically. They often voted against each other's most important pieces of legislation. Dan White found himself being defeated again and again and again. He was a very ineffective supervisor. At the same time, he had lost his job as a fireman because the city attorney had ruled he couldn't hold that job and be a supervisor, so his salary had fallen to $9,600 a year, which was what supervisors were paid. He had a sweetheart lease because he was a politician at Pier 39. He started a hot potato stand. But his wife, Mary Ann, was down there working. Their little son, Charlie, was often being carted down to the potato stand. Dan felt very, very, very pressured by all of this. And then, out in the face of all that pressure, he resigned abruptly and without having spoken to many people about his plans on November 10th. He simply tendered his resignation. He thought he was under pressure before. Now he really came under pressure. All the people who relied on him in City Hall, the Police Officers Association, the firefighters, the Chamber of Commerce, Quentin Kopp, lots of people, put pressure on him to ask to change his mind. So he went back to George Moscone, who was a man who didn't like to say no, and he explained to him that he now felt able to go on, and George said, well, sure, I'll give you your job back, which didn't sit well with George's constituents, including Harvey, who basically then told him, that's your job. You'll never be reelected mayor because Dan White is that magical 6th vote on the Board of Supervisors. If you return him to the Board of Supervisors, we liberals will continue to lose the close votes. And so George Moscone changed his mind. He had promised Dan White that he was going to tell him what his decision was, But he didn't do that. Dan White found out because a reporter called him at home and told him that the next day George Moscone was going to be appointing somebody else to his seat. For me, a key moment in understanding Dan White, because the first people I talked to about Dan White were his friends and his colleagues, and they all described him to me as a leader and a man among men and a gung-ho kind of guy. But I talked to his high school baseball coach, a guy named Jim Witt, who had coached him at Wilson High School. And Jim Witt had taken had a sympathy with Dan White, because Dan White had lost his father under very humiliating circumstances when he was about 15, 16 years old. And he was a little bit lost, and he was a little bit angry. And Jim Witt saw him as a stand-up guy, and he made him the captain of the baseball team. And one day, Jim Witt told me, he gave Dan White the bunt sign. He asked Dan White to bunt, and Dan White knew the signs. He was the captain of the team, and instead he ignored it, and he hit away. And after the inning, when he came into the bench, Jim Witt said to him, "Dan, why'd you do that? I gave you the bunt sign." And Dan White's response was to pull off his jersey, throw it down, stomp on it, and walk off the field, and he never came back and played for that team again. That was an important story to me because it told me something. It told me Dan White was a quitter. And now, when I looked at his career, I saw a very different career. I didn't see a guy moving through a series of leadership positions. I saw a guy cutting and running again and again and again. When things got tough, he got going. The second half of my book, the first half is about the events I've just described in a good deal more detail than I'm able to go into them here tonight. The second half of the book is about the trial. And the reason for that is, and that is the reason, one of the reasons I've called the book Double Play. The book is called Double Play because there were two assassinations. It's called Double Play because Dan White and the homicide detective who took that confession and then many years later took a real confession from Dan White privately had been the double play combination, shortstop and second baseman, on a police baseball team that won a state championship. But it was also called Double Play because, as someone who had lived through the events, as I know a lot of people in this room did, and then lived through the trial, there seemed to be an almost complete disconnect. What was being portrayed in the courtroom seemed to have very little to do with the background that I've already described to you. The assassinations provoked a silent candlelit march on City Hall, but the verdict provoked a riot. It was the event that people just could not tolerate. Dan White's lawyers, who did an excellent job, were not very interested in what people thought. Doug Schmidt, his chief attorney, said to me when I asked him a question about this, "Society has nothing to do with this. Only those 12 people in the jury box matter." But that's not true. I mean, it was true enough for Doug Schmidt having to conduct a defense, but it was also true that we here in San Francisco had a need to understand what had happened, had a need to see how it impacted our society, had a need to see how this act of utter incivility affected the union of civil people. All trials begin and end with the jury. First jury selection, and then a jury verdict. The prosecutor in this case, the chief prosecutor in the office of District Attorney Joe Freitas, was a man named Tom Norman. Tom Norman had prosecuted over 100 murder trials. I think he had won convictions in 96 or 97 of them. He was a very successful career prosecutor. And he told his boss, Joe Freitas, that this was the best first-degree case he had ever seen in his life. Freitas had an agenda of his own, the district attorney. He wanted to be mayor. And he had a little bit of a problem. His problem was that he could not be seen as going soft on Dan White. This was a murder prosecution. There was a death penalty waiting for Dan White if he was convicted of first-degree murder. But Fearful of being seen as soft on Dan White, Tommy Norman and Joe Freitas decided to bump all potential jurors who were opponents of the death penalty. Now, that was not a very clever strategy because most people who were anti-death penalty had voted for George Moscone and Harvey Milk, who were both also anti-death penalty. And so they ended up having in the jury box a jury that satisfied Tom Norman. It was his normal hanging jury. He had worked very well with these juries in the past. But the defense attorney, Schmidt and Scherr, saw something completely different. Looking at the same panel that satisfied Norman, Schmidt saw a jury much like he and Scherr had hoped for, but never expected to get. Excuse me, I have to decide whether or not I can read with my glasses on. Nine of the 12 had lived in San Francisco for 20 years or more and knew firsthand what was changing. There were more Catholics than non-Catholics, and four of the women were old enough to be Dan White's mother. If you had to guess, you'd say that only one or two at most might have voted for George Moscone. They were a pretty representative sample of the old and new San Francisco working class, a pretty good cross-section of the kind of people who felt oppressed and neglected by the political system, housewives and clerical workers for insurance companies and banks and corporations, a mechanic and a couple of printers, and the wife of a jailhouse employee. Most of them had spent the better part of their lives in the faded stretches of poor and modest neighborhoods south and east of Twin Peaks. So this was the jury the defense got. It got exactly the jury it wanted to. And the first important witness for the prosecution, and perhaps the most important witness they could have called, or it could have been the most important witness they did call, was the coroner, Boyd Stevens. Under the law, only the coroner could legally speculate as a witness, based on the evidence he had testified to, whether the killings had been carried out as deliberate acts. And Boyd Stevens had brought with him two mannequins, which he kept backstage. They weren't in the courtroom. They were in the area of the judge's office. And he was prepared to testify that they were deliberate and violent and vicious acts. However, before he had a chance to do that, Tommy Norman completed his examination of him. Doug Schmidt, very happy that Boyd Stevens had not been invited to give his opinion, didn't even cross-examine him. Because the defense had conceded from the beginning the obvious. Dan White had killed these two guys. He had confessed to it on tape. There was no question that he had killed them. Rather, his defense attorneys put to the jury a different set of questions. Their questions were, why? Why had a good man like Dan White, a man who had never, as far as anyone knows, committed a crime before in his life, do this heinous thing? And how must he be punished? Because the defense took the position that he had to be punished. But they said, this is not murder. This is a less serious crime. And they had a mantra, which they repeated again and again and again during the trial. Good people, fine people with fine backgrounds, simply don't kill in cold blood. It just doesn't happen. So let's find out what did happen. They seized the narrative. One of the things I thought watching the trial was that there was not a whole lot of difference between a trial and a basketball game. In a basketball game, both teams are trying to seize the momentum. They're trying to make the game proceed at the pace and in the style which they prefer. And that's exactly what Schmidt and Scherr did by posing the question that way. Their argument was simple. Dan White had cracked. He had been mentally ill all along, with a severe depression, although nobody had noticed. He had never seen a shrink, and it had never been diagnosed. And as if to underscore that, Dan White sat there throughout the trial like something of a zombie, the shell of a man. He stared straight ahead. He showed no expressions on his face. He seemed to take no notice of the testimony. He might have been catatonic, and yet he wasn't. As Steve Scherr, his other defense lawyer, told me, he wasn't catatonic. I played chess with him in jail. But you have to adopt some persona for a public ceremony like a trial, and that was Dan White's persona. He sat there like the shell of a man, and his lawyer, who resembled him physically, strode around the courtroom young and handsome and vigorous, as if to say, this is who this man was until this tragedy befell him. It worked. The defense called four psychiatrists and a psychologist to support their theory that under pressure and in the heat of passion, Dan White has cracked, and he was not able to execute a plan. His capacity to do that was diminished to such a degree that he was not legally culpable for murder. There was, however, in the diminished capacity law, one exception. If the killing was taken in revenge, then you cannot invoke, or you could not invoke, a diminished capacity defense. And of course, Dan White's killings had been acts of personal and political vengeance. But never once in the weeks of the trial, in the thousands of pages of transcripts, did the prosecutor, Thomas Norman, ever utter the word revenge. Not one time. It was an oversight bred in hubris. Tom Norman and Joe Freitas thought they had a sure thing, a slam dunk. And so they never even addressed, let alone answered, the question the jury most wanted to have answered. How did a handsome, young, working-class hero with a background so much like their own do something that horrible? It's easy to admire what they accomplished. They took a cold-blooded murderer, and they got him off, more or less. It was an amazing event. In his summation, Doug Schmidt, who never attends church and is not a God-fearing man, invoked God 21 times in 48 minutes. But the trial raised another question for me as well. Why are there psychiatrists and psychologists in this courtroom, I ask myself. I mean, they're not scientists. They're propagandists. They're like a paid political advertisement. If just once, just one time, a psychiatrist or a psychologist testifying at a trial testified unfavorably to the side that was paying him, then I might have a different view of their profession when it's used in behalf of a defendant. But they don't do that. And Dan White served his time in Soledad. He was released in January of 1984, paroled to Los Angeles, lived there for a year. During the time, I'm never going to make it. During the time that he was there, he called up his old friend Frank Falzon. He asked him to come down to visit him in Los Angeles. And while Falzon was there, he told him the truth. He said, yeah, I went down to City Hall that day to kill George and Harvey, and I also wanted to kill Willie Brown and Carol Ruth Silver, another supervisor. Perhaps more than anything else, what that final confession made clear to me was something I had already believed based on my research. Dan White didn't kill Harvey because he was gay. He killed Harvey because Harvey was one of the people who had defeated and humiliated him at City Hall. He wanted to kill Harvey as part of a gang of four. After his year's parole in Los Angeles, and against the wishes of Mayor Dianne Feinstein, he returned to San Francisco. He had no job. There were threats on his life. He now had three kids, including one who had been conceived in a conjugal visit at Soledad and had Down syndrome. He wasn't living at home because he and his wife, Mary Ann, had decided it was too dangerous to the children. He had just begun seeing a shrink, one of the shrinks who had testified in his behalf because his wife insisted on it. He had just begun taking lithium for depression. It was the first time, as far as I can tell, that he had received any treatment of any kind for the underlying mental illness that had gotten him off. And then, just one second. There we go. With Marianne and the kids gone for the day, Dan was free to make his preparations. He wrote a final journal entry, pulling out a worn briefcase where he kept his notebooks in the back of a space under a stairway. The last entry was not neat and controlled, as was his habit. It was scrawled diagonally across the entire page. "My dearest Marianne, my last journal entry is written to express my ever faithful love for you and our children, your devoted husband, Danny, October 21st, 1985. He returned the briefcase to its place, and now he readied his own gas chamber. A 1973 Buick LeSabre in his garage, he attached a garden hose to the exhaust pipe and ran it through the passenger side rear window, sealing the gap with a towel. He sat in the Buick and pulled the door closed. He clutched family photos. In the tape deck, he put a mournful Irish ballad of suppression and rebellion, "The Town I Loved So Well." "For what's done is done," it says, "and what's won is won, and what's lost, and gone forever in the town I loved so well." You'd have thought that Dan White had enough of martyrdom. He hadn't. He turned the key in the ignition. His final act was to condemn himself, perhaps convict and condemn himself, and thus he quit on those who needed him most, his wife, his three small kids who would grow up without a father, as Dan had, in fact, grown up fatherless himself. The consequences of this terrible crime and terrible miscarriage of justice are still being felt today. In my view, it was the crime of the 20th century in San Francisco. I think perhaps only the Patty Hearst kidnapping could possibly compete with it. And it changed many things. I'll just go through a few of them really quickly because I know time is running short and we want to do some questions and answers. The first was it created Dianne Feinstein. I've been prompted that I have 5 minutes. Dianne Feinstein had run twice unsuccessfully for mayor. She was telling her friends she was no longer going to run for political office when her term on the Board of Supervisors as its president was up. She was going to withdraw from politics. On the day of the assassinations, as I'm sure everybody in this room knows, it was she who made the announcement in a pink pantsuit that was splattered with blood from having been one of the first people to Harvey Milk's body and having Harvey Milk's blood all over her. And, of course, her good performance as mayor catapulted her career forward, and she has become, as we know, the most powerful Democratic politician in the state of California and has been for quite a long time now. And because she became mayor and George Moscone was no longer mayor, the city moved in a more conservative way, particularly in regard to Manhattanization, which I don't have to explain in this room, I suppose. The skyline changed much more dramatically quickly than it would have under Moscone, who was allied with those groups who opposed a rapid expansion of downtown. And so the city's skyline, the city's politics, and our representation in Congress all changed dramatically as a result of Dan White. District elections, which is what had brought Dan and Harvey to City Hall in the first place, were discarded by the voters at that time, although later reinstated. In the legal area, the diminished capacity was a defense was, well, the legislature tried to eliminate the diminished capacity defense. They did pass bills that were intended to do that, although it's still possible to conduct a state of mind defense. You have to frame it a little bit differently, but you can those same kind of defenses are still being put forward. And but of all the consequences of his act, probably the one that he least intended was this one. The biggest change Dan White wrought was unintended. The acceptance of gay people here and in many other places across the country was inspired in part by the martyrdom of Harvey Milk. In fact, within a couple of months of the of Harvey's assassination, 100,000 people showed up in Washington for a gay rights march, and many of them were carrying placards and pictures that invoked the memory of Harvey Milk. In death, Harvey's influence grew far greater than he had any reason to expect it would have been had he lived. Harvey's life and death became the subject of an opera, an Academy Award-winning documentary, and the 2008 movie Milk, which earned Sean Penn an Oscar for his betrayal of Harvey. It's a testament to unintended consequences that although Dan White did not kill Harvey Milk because he was gay, the assassination of a courageous and pioneering leader galvanized the movement and assured Harvey's place in history. Dan White is all but forgotten. George Moscone has his name on a convention center and a playground where he passed part of his youth. But Harvey Milk will live forever. Old journalists never die. They just keep on making their deadlines.
Thank you, Mike Weiss, author of Double Play, The Hidden Passions Behind the Double Assassination of George Moscone and Harvey Milk, for your participation this evening. I'm Stephen Seward, chair of the club's LGBT forum, and I'll be moderating today's question and answer period. And we have quite a few.
Oh, good.
Boop, boop.
Your description of the White Knight riots was fascinating to me. It happened when I was still quite young, but mm-hmm. just all the detail that you brought out with Dianne Feinstein upstairs and the crowds trying to tear down the building,
yeah,
throwing tear gas in the building, it was really chaotic. And Carol Ruth Silver got hit in the face with a rock. And
yes.
It was. Could you talk a little bit more about just how crazy it was for Dianne Feinstein and what was going on inside?
Well, I mean, you know, City Hall was packed with police officers, and they were also being held back at the sides. But at the point at which City Hall did come under attack, the police were released. And one of the really interesting things that I saw that night was I heard this grunting and banging behind me, and I was just standing in the middle of the riot, and I turned around. There were these two women. One was a dyke on bikes, and she was dressed in leathers, and she was like sort of built like Sonny Liston. And the other one was a lady cop who was also built like Sonny Liston, and the two of them were just standing there throwing haymakers at each other. They were just pounding on each other. That was one of the things that led me to say this wasn't a riot, this was a fight. I think the really important thing about it is that it was an insurrection of law-abiding people who felt exposed, vulnerable, and furiously angry.
What do you think would have happened to George Moscone?
If he had lived?
Yeah.
He might well have been reelected mayor. He might not have been. I've talked to many people of both opinions. He would have gone on in a career in politics, I'm absolutely certain.
Maybe even if Dianne Feinstein's Senate seat.
No, I don't think George was that big myself. But, I mean, I hope I'm not offending anybody. I hope no friends or relatives of George's are here. I thought he was a very good mayor, although the received wisdom now is that he was a terrible mayor. But, you know, Gavin Newsom was supposed to be a terrible mayor. Barack Obama is a terrible president. Someone thinks everybody's terrible.
And George wasn't from tremendous money, though, was he?
Oh, no, not at all.
Yeah.
All three men were of modest means, absolutely. All three men could be described as having had working class upbringings.
It's hard to imagine after Willie and Gavin,
yes,
mayors that have been so affluent.
Gavin has money?
So someone lists three calamities, and they'd like you to rank them. The earthquake of 1989, the Zodiac murders, and the assassination of Mayor Moscone and Harvey.
Well, they're very different events, aren't they? The earthquake of 89 had some terrible consequences. I mean, people died and people lost their homes, but it was kind of fun. For those of us who weren't directly injured or suffered great losses, it was a very exciting time, and it was one of those wonderful times in the face of particularly natural tragedies in which people come together and behave very well. And I'll never forget the picture of Joe DiMaggio standing in line with a lot of other people hoping to get back into his place in the marina and see if he could salvage some of his possessions. The Zodiac killings were, they weren't a single event. They were over a period of time. More dramatic to me was the Patty Hearst kidnapping and the SLA forcing the Hearst family to distribute free food around the city. That was a pretty good deal. I don't know how to rank them because they're so different each from the other. I wrote about all three of them, so I guess they were interesting enough to write about.
And Dan White was very connected with Ireland in a misty kind of coffee table book kind of way.
Well, he wanted to be – I mean, he saw his Irish heritage as having given him the gift of writing. He very much wanted to be a writer. And I've read some of his stuff. I mean, it's very, very stiff, as Dan was himself. After he was released from parole, and during the time when he was mostly living in San Francisco, he actually went over to Ireland to write, but he didn't write anything. He did take out Irish citizenship, which he was entitled to, because I believe it was his mother or his grandmother, I don't remember now, one of them had been born in Ireland, and therefore he was entitled to Irish citizenship. He didn't write anything, and he ran out of money, and he asked Marianne, his wife, to please send him the money to come home, and she said, only if you see a shrink. So he came home, and that's how come he began to see Dr. Lundy.
And they honeymooned in Ireland.
They honeymooned in Ireland.
With problems in the bedroom.
Yes, definite problems in the bedroom. Marianne testified to that during the trial. Marianne was a very important element in the trial. She's a woman of great dignity, and reserve, and she sat there every day looking fragrant and worried half to death, sitting right behind Dan on the other side of that security glass that created such a distorting effect. And then, of course, she testified for her husband.
So what did the folded-up book jacket mean?
Oh, well, you know, I think Dan White saw the situation in San Francisco as being oppressive, that the old established Irish and Italian, but primarily Irish families who had run this city for a long time were being oppressed, supplanted by these new people who wanted to change the city in unacceptable ways. And so he saw a connection between the oppression of the Irish by the English. Sorry, Rita. And the oppression of the older San Franciscans by newer San Franciscans, and it also had a powerful draw because it was his homeland.
Is that what drew him to the hot potato?
No, what drew him to the hot potato was that Warren Simmons, who wanted to build the hot potato, needed a lot of permits and needed not a lot of help at City Hall, and Dan White was a supervisor, and so he got the best stand on Pier 39 right when you came in the door. It was the first stand in there. You can get yourself some potatoes.
There wasn't a lot of discussion about Dan White's time at Soledad. What was his prison years like? Was he accepted in the population?
He was kept in isolation. He was considered to be at risk and in danger. Someone who was kept in isolation with him in a nearby isolation cell, and they were released for an hour a day to run. They both could run at the same time on the track with Sirhan Sirhan. So it was like a festival of assassins.
Were you a fan of the true crime genre before you wrote Double Play?
No.
No?
No. No, I like to read novels.
And what happened to Dan's two kids?
Well, I mean, the Down syndrome son still lives with his mother. And although I'm told he's quite highly functioning. And Dan's oldest son, Charlie, left the state and visits occasionally. He actually came to San Francisco when they were shooting the film Milk, and Sean Penn had him on the set as his guest. That was an event that caused a great deal of consternation on the set. Several people, I've had two different people tell me they called the cops because it was pretty frightening. I mean, here Sean Penn was portraying Harvey Milk, and here was Dan White's son, and he seemed to be somewhat angry. But everything calmed down. Apparently, Sean Penn did a great job and took him out to dinner or lunch and calmed him down, and things went on. So,
someone asks, it's been my experience that gun-toting conservatives are always, in their hearts, cowards. What is your opinion?
I would endorse that in this case. I can't imagine a more cowardly act than shooting two unarmed men.
Was there a moment during the trial when you knew the defense was going to succeed?
Yes, when the confession was played. The confession was played by the prosecution. It was Inspector Frank Falzon, Dan White's old double play partner, who introduced the confession, which he had taken on the day of the assassinations, and played it. And I was listening closely to the confession, and I thought it was completely self-serving. One of the things that struck me right away was that Dan White only cried when he was talking about how hard his wife worked and how his kid had to go to a babysitter. He never showed any emotion when talking about Harvey Milk and George Moscone, nor did he show any concern whatsoever for their friends and family and the people they had left behind. And so I thought it was a cold and self-serving confession. And I turned to the jury box, and people were crying. Jurors were crying. What they heard was the raw emotion of this obviously shell-shocked man. I mean, he was a mess when he gave that confession. And that's what they heard, because they wanted to believe in him.
Was that the big tactical error of the whole trial?
Playing the confession? Well, no, because if the prosecution hadn't played it, the defense was prepared to play it. They knew it was going to play that way with this particular jury. That's why I said the jury was so significant. They heard the confession in one way. Now, I, as a person who felt that this was a heinous crime and that George Moscone and Harvey Milk were people I had voted for, heard it completely differently.
So Dan had a stable home life.
You know, there were a lot of kids. They grew up in a pretty rough section of Visitation Valley, and there were a lot of kids. And then after his dad died, and that was a terrible event in his life, his mother married another fireman. And I forget the exact number, but there were 17 siblings and step-siblings in that family. In fact, on the day of the assassinations, if you listen, one of the things that we've done with this new edition is in the back of the book, we've included a DVD that includes Dan White's entire confession. You can listen to it for yourself and see what you think. But it also includes many of the police transmissions, police radio transmissions on the day of the assassinations. And the first police dispatcher that you hear is a woman, and then later it switches to a man. The woman was one of Dan White's sisters. She was the on-duty dispatcher that day.
And in the weeks or months leading up to the tragedy, Harvey Milk had been through quite turbulent times as well, yeah, in his personal life?
Yeah, but I don't remember what it was.
Tell me.
A lover hung himself in his...
Was that just weeks before? I think it was just weeks before. I didn't realize it was that close. I'll have to read the book. Thank you.
It seems interesting that Dan had his a wife and a family, and Harvey had all this turmoil, but it's crazy.
Yeah. What do you think would have happened to Harvey if he had lived?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. No gay person had ever been elected mayor. I'm sure he would have tried, or if not that, he would have tried for an assembly seat. I think he probably would have gone far, but he would have become, in historical terms, another important early gay politician, period, not the person he became, not the subject of operas and Academy Award-winning films and books and so on.
There's a question about the Twinkie defense.
Ah, okay.
It was a much bigger issue in the newspapers, yeah?
The Twinkie defense, I seem to have lost my pen. Okay. Thank you. The phrase Twinkie defense was made up by Paul Krasner, who's a satirist. Paul was also at the trial. He was, quote, covering it for Playboy. I think it took him 2 years to get the piece into Playboy. But Paul once won a slow bicycle race, so that's not surprising. But You know, one of the one of the points that the psychiatrist and the psychologist were making, and the defense picked up on, was that Dan White, who had been very concerned with his good health and his physical, he was a very strong and athletic kind of guy. He had abandoned his usual good dietary habits and was gorging on junk food and feeling very sorry for himself and moping around the house in his bathrobe and so on and so forth. And one of the psychiatrists, Martin Blinder, Marty's available for hire if anybody wants him, mentioned that he had eaten some Twinkies. And so it got seized upon. It was a throwaway line in a piece of garbage testimony. It had almost nothing to do with the trial. But it became the phrase by which the trial is known. History is formed in very peculiar ways, you know.
It was very critical where Dan reloaded, right?
Absolutely, it was an incredibly important point, and again, the prosecution blew it. In his confession, Dan White says unequivocally that he reloaded in Harvey Milk's office before asking Harvey Milk to join him in killing him. But the defense contended that Dan White had reloaded over George Moscone's body. These two people were a block apart. We all know City Hall, one office on one side of City Hall, the other office on the other side of City Hall. The defense contended that Dan White reloaded over George Moscone instinctively out of his police and army training. That was not true. Dan White reloaded just before he called Harvey into his office. And once again, the prosecution they allowed the defense to make that argument, and they didn't just shoot it down by replaying the tape where Dan says, "I reloaded in my own office." Because clearly, that would be indicative, again, of first-degree murder. I mean, if you kill somebody, now you've killed somebody, and then you run a block across City Hall, and then you reload your weapon and kill somebody else, well, that does seem as though it is deliberate, doesn't it? Again, the prosecution Tommy Norman thought he had a slam dunk case with his typical hanging jury, and it was a failure of imagination. He did not see that if you have a two-time convicted black felon sitting there being accused of his third felony, the jury is probably going to view him one way. And if you have a white upstanding member of the community sitting there, the jury is going to be inclined to view him very differently.
And all this took place just, what, days after Jonestown?
The assassinations were 10 days after Jonestown, and it was the darkest, gloomiest period in the history of San Francisco. I just can't imagine. Maybe the fire, of course. 1906 was darker. Well, a lot of bright light in 1906 was more devastating. First Jonestown, and you know, most of the people who died in Jonestown, as we all know, were people from around here. So almost everybody knew somebody or knew somebody who knew somebody who had been lost in Jonestown. And then 10 days later, this happened, and it just seemed impossible. I remember on the night of the assassinations, after I had filed my stories and so on, and I was taking the Jay Church home from the building where Time Magazine was housed down in the financial district out to Noe Valley. And it was silent in the city as the trolley rolled through the city. There were lots of people out, and there was no noise. People were beyond words. You couldn't speak, you know. It was just too much, too awful.
And Jim Jones was part of the coalition that brought George Money to
Well, Jim, yes. In fact, the reason Jim Jones fled is a couple of very good reporters, Phil Tracy and Marshall Kildoff, were preparing an article in which they had gone to members of People's Temple and said, disaffected members of People's Temple, who claimed that Jones was beating them and stealing their money and sleeping with their wives or husbands and so on. And they were preparing this article which was going to blow the lid off who Jim Jones really was. And keep in mind that he was an ally of Willie Brown and George Moscone because he could turn out the people of People's Temple to walk precincts. They had a very disciplined cadre of precinct walkers, and Jim Jones was aware this article was about to be published. Somebody actually broke into the offices of New West Magazine and rifled the files, trying to destroy the article before it could be published. And then, when it was clear it was going to be published, that was when Jim Jones left. So it was very much connected. And George Moscone and Willie Brown defended Jim Jones until the day he died. History is tragedy, not melodrama.
What about Tommy Norman and Joe Freitas after the trial? Was that the end of their careers, or what happened to them?
Well, I mean, Joe Freitas had no political future at all. He was through, and he left politics. Tom Norman went on prosecuting cases. Doug Schmidt and Steve Scherr, who beat Tommy Norman in this trial, liked Tommy Norman. I know I wasn't particularly friendly toward Tommy Norman. I mean, I didn't describe his style, but if you could imagine, remember Stanley Tucci sort of slithering through The Devil Wore Prada? That was kind of Tommy's. Tommy never would say sir, said if he could say aver. He was a very formal, pretentious kind of guy with a widow's peak. He went on working. Schmidt and Scherr felt so badly for him that they seriously discussed offering him a partnership in their firm. They liked Tommy Norman. A lot of people around the whole of justice liked Tommy Norman and were sorry to see that he had messed up big time. It sort of wiped out all the accomplishments of the rest of his life, and he's no longer among us. So may he rest in peace.
We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and we're listening to Double Play, How Dan White Got Away with Murder and Changed San Francisco, with reporter and author Mike Weiss. Unfortunately, Mike, we've reached the point in our program where there's time for just one last question. And I guess I'd like to know, how would the city be different today if it were not for these tragedies?
Huh. I don't know that it would be. Dianne Feinstein probably wouldn't be the U.S. Senator, but I don't know if that has much effect on the life of the city. There wouldn't be streets and buildings named after Harvey and George, but other than that, I don't think it really would be a different city. A lot of time has gone by. History flows forward, and things go on, and I don't see that on a daily kind of basis it makes much difference. In fact, we've got district elections again, right? I mean, they're back in again. I can never keep track. I don't live in the city anymore. It's such a pity I don't get to vote for the Board of Supervisors. But I can never keep track of when they're in and when they're out, because it seems to be a constant back and forth. But I honestly would say that I don't know of any differences that we would feel in our lives today if this hadn't occurred, except for those few names and so on. Anyone disagree? Someone want to give a better answer than that? Because that was a pretty weak answer.
Well, our thanks to Mike Weiss, author of Double Play, The Hidden Passions Behind the Double Assassination of George Moscone and Harvey Milk, for his participation in tonight's program.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
We also thank our audiences here, as well as those listening to our recording, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
Miles, are you here?